Ang pamagat ng aking papel ay Rizal, Spain, Rizal on Spain. My good friend Rizal, specialist Ambet Ocampo, are you there? said that while Rizal is everywhere, for many objects were named after him, Rizal School, Rizal Park, Rizal Theater, Rizal Street, Rizal Matches, Rizal Cement, Rizal Pandesal. He is really nowhere. Certainly not in the hearts and minds of many of his countrymen. In 1996, I read a program and I read a title of Ambet's paper, Scraping the Rizal Barrel. But he did not come because he was not invited. And yet this morning, Ambet bids us once more to consider the agenda for Rizal studies for the next 150 years, to scrape the Rizal barrel smooth, where certainly there would be more facts, insights, and interpretations not yet seen or explored. I must admit that the seed for this paper may be found in the walking tour that Ambet and I took over a decade ago in the streets of Madrid. We finally landed in the Parque Maria Luisa, where the Centro de Investigaciones Superiores were selling books on the Philippines for maybe $2 a piece. Gaspar de San Agustin, Diego Duarte, and the most famous Recopilación de las Leyes de las Indias. And so we parted, I'm sure, because Ambet is a very rich man, but I parted with most of my dollars, and so I had very little money left. We decided we were not going to eat paella at the El Corte Inglés, which would have been $15 at the time. And so we landed at that landmark of Spanish assimilation of American culture, El Restaurante Rápido Quick. We had very little money, and then we sent all our books. We were very happy because, you know, a professor at UP would be so elated to receive a gift of Gaspar de San Agustin, Conquistas de las Islas Filipinas, not knowing that it cost only $1.50. If we were in the company of another Filipinist by the name of Ricky Jose, brother of Rico, we would have tarried longer because he would have lingered at the azoteas and the balconies. But all of us, I'm sure, know that the streets and the landmarks and the buildings in Madrid were not the same buildings during Rizal's time. And so we wondered, how did Lolo Jose look at Spain, and in particular, Madrid during his time? I ventured to consider this in today's paper, which I had already read some time ago. This is not a travelogue. Partly my own engagement with Rizal studies came by the way of History 106 at the University of the Philippines. 106 is History of Spain, a one-semester course for history majors. In this course, I found out semester after semester that the students showed very little understanding of the need to see the conjunctures between Philippine history and that of Spain, even though one of the most obvious periods would have been the years spent by Filipino reformists in Madrid and Barcelona in the last two decades of the 19th century. My usual questions to the students concerned, one, the political and economic conditions obtaining in Madrid and in Spain at the time of their sojourn, and two, their activities in Spain. Finally, have they looked at Rizal, the central figure of the group, and did they have any idea as to how he lived his life in Europe? Kilala ba natin talaga si Lolo Jose? The survey course on Philippine history during the freshman year would not have provided the necessary information, never mind that they had taken the Rizal course and had read the standard biographies. They had absolutely no idea at all. It is fairly clear, therefore, that to be able to teach the Rizal course, the instructor must have a good background in Philippine and Spanish histories. The following essay, therefore, proceeds from my study of Rizal's life in Spain and Spanish politics and culture while he was there. While I think I might have taught the students of Spanish history a point or two, it was I who learned the most from my own research. This study looks into the political and cultural conditions obtaining in Spain in the 19th century and examines Rizal's reactions to the political instability of the last third of that period, which many students of Spanish history consider a critical prelude to the catastrophe that was the Civil War of 1936 and 1939. In 1882, the Rizal family decided to send the young Jose Rizal to Spain. We know that the real reason behind this decision was to shield Rizal from the dangers of authoritarian rule and prosecution. Ever the dutiful son, and at the strong urgings of his older brother, Paciano, Rizal readied himself for a momentous sojourn in Spain. On the surface of it, Rizal's days in Spain were taken up by study as he picked up one meritorious degree after another. Another reality was that it was a painful life of exile. The family decision to protect Rizal by sending him to the epicenter of the Spanish Empire may have sealed the fate he met in December 1896. In order to explain the foregoing remarks, we need to review the political situation in Spain in the half century or so before Rizal's arrival in Spain in 1882. The century of political turbulence that ended in the Civil War of 1936-1939 may be said to have started with the death of Ferdinand VII and the succession of his daughter, Isabella II. After her birth, the Salic Law, which prohibited female succession, was hastily revoked. Her assumption to power threw Spain into indescribable turmoil. The king's brother, Don Carlos, contested his ascent to power. The Carlistas, coming from the agrarian elites, particularly from the region of Aragon and Navarra, opposed the rise to power of Isabel. A six-year war ensued, 100 years before the Civil War of 1936. The regency would not have survived were it not for the support of the army. In 1840, after the First Carlist War, the army was pivotal in the forced resignation of Maria Cristina and supported the ascendancy of the liberals, which governed as a regency along with the assumption into the monarchy of Isabel. The country's politicians, all coming from the narrow elite, were deeply divided into liberals, progressives, and moderates. All three factions sought support from the military. Isabel's reign from 1840 to 1868 was backed by a string of army officers who were supported by personalist political leaders from the center down to the local by political leaders called caciques who delivered the vote for government candidates in return for the spoils of political victory. The government turned a blind eye to the urgent need for land reform Economic growth was negligible. The Catholic Church continued to wield great political and economic power and virtually unchecked role in the educational system. The army soon grew tired of Isabel. General Juan Prim executed a coup d'etat, and he found one suitable candidate to rule the country, Amadeo Savoy. Prim himself was assassinated, leaving Savoy without a mentor nor enough power to supervise the establishment of a stable government. The civil government was no better. Provincial and city governments declared their independence of Madrid, which had little or no control over Spain or the remnants of her empire. All that was necessary was for another army to execute a coup to restore the monarchy. And that monarch was Alfonso XII, who reigned from 1875 to 1885. He encouraged what is known as the turno, which means that conservatives and liberals took turns governing the empire. This turno system brought to the Philippines a rapid alternation of liberal and conservative governors, which meant that you had no government at all. On the seventh year of Alfonso's reign, José Rizal arrived in Madrid to matriculate at the university. It was not a good time to be in Spain, as we shall soon see. From the time he boarded the ship to the time he arrived in Barcelona, he wrote several letters that show us the keen faculty of observation and analysis, a quality of prescience even. Once in Spain, his letters were dominated by nostalgia, of reminiscing about life in the Philippines, of persistent nagging of Paciano that he besent his allowances so that his life in the Spanish capital might be less miserable. His letters to his immediate family, relatives, and friends are important to us, not only for what they say, but for what he did not say. He was not alone. In Spain, he had joined an elite group of indios, the Filipinas, driven out of the colony by friar prejudice and persecution. It is said that in Madrid and Barcelona, as well as Paris and London, there were Filipinos who formed expatriate communities. I will not mention their names. You're familiar with them already. They are cited in Rizal's voluminous correspondence. All were self-exiles who left the Philippines either because they would be prosecuted by the colonial government or expected to be arrested at the instigation of the powerful clergy. All were spending their own money or their parents' money because there were no scholarships at that time. I think that we should consider paying some attention to the role of sugar money in the late 19th century in the support of expatriate Filipino colonies in Europe. A good number preferred medicine and law. Rizal towered above them all, for he excelled in every field or discipline he took an interest in. Dapper in their Americanas and chaquetes, fluent in Spanish or French, they belie the allegation of the Augustinian priest Eduardo Navarro and other clerics who said, in opposing the intention of the peninsular government to improve the educational system in the Philippines, that the government should not waste its time and money because the indios were incapable of education and learning. He observed that the Filipinos abound here. This is another paper for you, the OFWs in the late 19th century. There are merchants, travelers, tourists, employees, military men, students, artists, lawyers, agents, I don't know of what, cooks, servants, coachmen, women, children, very old men. And Rizal said, I cannot ascertain what the effect of this migration will be in the future. Of course, there were Filipinos who proved to be a source of embarrassment to the Filipino colony. Writing to Paciano, Rizal lamented, "Meron ditong dulos ng dulos, pangal na pangal, na siya lamang katatawanan ng iba at hiya ng kasamahan. Bakit kaya pinabaya ang baglakbaybayan? Ang kapangalan ay sumusuko dahilan sa aro-aro iyong karapatang bagang italas ay ipinupurol at nagpapakita ng katangaan. Uuwi ng kulang ang mga magagandang ugali ng ating mga kababayan ay nalilimutan at ang napupulot ay ang mga basahan ng taga rito." Rizal provided very little description of Madrid and its environs. He said, "Although it may seem strange, living in a city may also be monotonous, even if this city is monotonous, even if this city is called Madrid." But once outside the capital, and when he finally quit Spain to travel to Paris in Germany, his letters were more voluminous and enthusiastic, waxing profoundly and eloquently on things he did and the human condition that he had seen. Did he perhaps undertake to censor himself? And why? We must remember that he had not yet written the Noli Me Tangere. Rizal does not tell us that in the years when he was in Spain, the metropole had suffered from extreme problems of disease and hunger. In 1885, there was a great cholera epidemic, owing partly to chronic malnutrition and periodic hunger, due in turn to very poor harvest, which in turn may be attributed to general poverty and agrarian underdevelopment. According to Nicolás Sánchez Albornoz, there were worrisome and significant periods of hunger during the period 1879 to 1898, part of which Rizal were in Spain. Indeed, la mortalidad infantil era especialmente elevada. De cada 1,000 nacidos, murieron 429 antes de cumplir los 5 años de edad. Ibig sabihin, sa bawat 1,000 pinapanganak, mahigit 400 ang namamatay bago sila ikalimang taong gulang. Okay? Sa Espanya, namamatay ang mga tao ng 29 years old, patay na. Okay? E sa Francia, 43 years old ang limit at sa Switzerland ay 50. Okay? Indeed, in July 1885, Rizal wrote his mother that there is cholera in Spain and also in Madrid. For every 100 people, 34 are dying. I didn't get that statistic from a Spanish author. I got my statistics from Rizal. "If I don't receive by the next mail a letter from you, I'm going to enlist to take care of cholera patients. For they say they give 12 pesos daily. And so I will earn in 1 month some 250 pesos that will be sufficient to support me for 5 months. Okay? But no letter came from Doña Teodora, so he did not enlist. The only commentary on the Spanish political situation in his letters to his family that was at length was contained in letters to Paciano dated January 18 and 21, 1884, and another letter to Paciano in November 1884. The students in the colleges of law and medicine had demonstrated against the Minister of Finance on the issue of graft and corruption. At the opening of the school year, a liberal professor of history, Miguel Moraita, proclaimed academic freedom. The bishops excommunicated him, and in return, the students and faculty remonstrated with a big manifestation excommunicating the bishops. The city government ordered the police to enter the university, 200 in all, with sabers and revolvers, and the faculty remonstrated, but to no avail. The police, according to Rizal, committed the barbarous outrage without equal in the history of the country for the first time. They attacked the university with sabers. Upon order of the governor, they attacked the rector. Many were wounded. Blood was spilled on the stairways and corridors of the university. They laid their hands on the rector, seized the secretary, insulted the professors, wounded the students, and there was much shooting. Rizal wondered. One policeman was looking at him intently. He did not know that he was in the blacklist. The following week, he mailed Paciano copies of the liberal newspapers El Imperial, El Dia, and El Liberal. Rizal and Valentin Ventura narrowly escaped arrest. He disguised himself three times in order to avoid detection. He wrote to Paciano, "Here is the reason why I say that studying at Madrid disillusions me. It can no longer be an honor to anyone to come from this institution that has been dishonored, outraged, debased, oppressed, tyrannized." Although Rizal did not write much to his family about the political events in Spain during his sojourn there, he was certainly aware of what was going on. There were many newspapers in Spain, 917 altogether at the end of the 19th century. See, they were allowed because the government thought that that was a way to reduce opposition. I have a long paper. I'm jumping because I only have three minutes to go. Rizal would have known about the rise of socialism and anarchism and peasant uprisings outside Madrid in Cartagena and Andalusia, and the continued perpetuation of feudalism in many parts of Spain. But he did not write about this. The capital city of Madrid did not impress him. Madrid and Barcelona were filthy cities. Constrained to save his precious pesetas, he probably rented less than favorable rooms. If you read the letters, you will see that the letters from Madrid did not have specific addresses. The letters from Brussels, from Paris, from London, from Germany, from Ghent had specific addresses. His letters from these cities were full of enthusiasm. Okay? And he said, a boarding house in Barcelona, he says, "Our house is 1,000 times more decent than that." The empire's capital to him was particularly ugly. When it rains, like a fine tikatik, the streets were filled with dirty and thick mud. The ground was slippery, and between the holes in the old and worn-out pavement were pools of water and little marshes like lubluban ng mga kalabaw. In the 1880s, Madrid was building itself as the center of the empire. So, it was not possible to describe it the way you would describe Madrid now. The city at the time of Rizal's sojourn was in a state of unfortunate transition. The department store and landmark buildings that were already fixtures in such cities as London and Paris did not exist in Madrid. For one thing, it had no industry to speak of. But there was massive abandono de campo. There was massive in-migration from the provinces to Madrid. And the government did not help the situation because they sought to locate the poor to the poor districts and encourage the building of rich suburbs and enclaves. And Rizal in the 1880s saw all of this. And why not? He had very little money to take the Tranvía ride. He had very little money. Did you know that he had very little money to eat three meals a day? One relative must have grated on his nerves because he was asking and borrowing, asking money, okay, from Pasiano, from his parents. Pasiano, at the time of poor sugar harvest, had said, "I had managed to sell 137 loaves of muscovado, and I am now sending you 70 pesos. 50 pesos was his allowance for the month. And so Rizal remonstrated by a particularly poignant letter. I'm jumping. Okay. He said, "I too have suffered much here. And since I have been in Europe twice, I have seen the day, I have seen many a day pass without eating for not having a real, okay? And I do not complain. I suffered the cold and the rain, and I couldn't take the streetcar because I have nothing to pay the fare when my feet were swollen and aching. I do not forget even a single moment the sacrifices that I cost the family and how greatly I'm lessening our modest fortune. And you can understand how I wish to be able to earn my living in order to cease being a burden to the family. In Madrid, as in almost the greater part of Spain, there are certain prejudices to which one has to adjust himself, however independent he may be. To earn my living here in my condition without giving occasion to murmuring, I would have to resort to employment, to politics, for manual work here is usually considered humiliating, and frankly, I have no courage to drag myself to the office of the minister to beg with my salutations for a salary that would make you as well as myself ashamed. Here, politics is the soul of everything. It is injected into the trades, arts, letters, and sciences. Even the bullfighters, poets, and others who are worthless must join politics. The learned man, if he is not a politician, is not learned. Even cholera has been made a political question. Even the bacillus itself, the origin of disease, is a political question. If you haven't lived here, make an effort to imagine how one lives here. I, who have always considered myself a foreigner in this country, and as such, I have always called myself and have not concealed my indifference from all those who have proposed to me the political parties, cannot now solicit their patronage without incurring in contradiction in my soul. Moreover, for every position that appears in the horizon, there are some 15 or 14 aspirants crowding the doors and halls of the ministers who have to walk away fleeing from them. But Rizal did not have it in him to criticize the social conditions in the metropolitan center. Mind and body, soul and spirit were only interested in ameliorating the Philippine condition through his pen. That is why he resisted Marcelo del Pilar's demands and importunings that he write in the Solidaridad articles exposing the shortcomings of the empire, attacks on graft and peculation in the peninsular government. In his assessment, the true enemy was not in Spain, but the Augustinian, Dominican, and Franciscan clergy that held the Philippines in their iron grip. In fact, Spain should lead and initiate reform in the colony. Why is it not doing anything? Because it was busy minding its own business in the peninsula. Rizal and the other reformists wrote in Spanish to drive home the urgent message that the crown should not lose any time to initiate change for the good of the colony. Otherwise, the worsening conditions of the Indios would drive them to rise against Spain. Finally, the Nolimi Tangere and El Filibusterismo, although written in Spanish for the Spaniards to read, were also directed at the Indio elite. The contention that the two novels were the sparks that lit the Philippine Revolution sometimes boggles the mind. Just how many barefoot Indios in the late 19th century knew enough Spanish to understand the two novels and LIMN, the message within? Rizal's efforts did not bear fruit. It was time to come home and adopt a different, more radical strategy to attain the country's redemption. We get this sense in his last letter from Europe under his nom de plume, Laong Laan, to friends in Barcelona in October 1891. Let me read a letter in the original Tagalog. Kung ang inaasahan ng ating mga kababayan ay tayo rito sa Europa, totoo silang namamali. Ako'y ayaw magdaya sa kanino man. Ang ating maitutulong sa kanila ay ang ating buhay para sa ating bayan. Ang parang na paglalabanan ay ang Pilipinas. Doon dapat tayo magtatagpo. Doon tayo magtutulong-tulong. Doon tayo sama-samang magdusa o magtagumpay kaya. Huwag umasa ang Pilipinas sa Espanya. Umasa sa sariling lakas. For the benefit of the non-Filipinos, our countrymen are truly mistaken if they would depend upon us who are here in Europe. I do not wish to deceive anyone. We can only help them by giving our lives to our people. The arena of battle is the Philippines. There we should come together. There we should help one another. There we should suffer together, or maybe triumph together. Filipinas should not hope, rely on our own strength. In June of the following year, he was back in Manila. On the third day of July, Rizal presided over a meeting in Tondo that founded the La Liga Filipina. 3 days later, the Governor General banished him to the Pitan. The outbreak of the revolution the following month caught him in a maelstrom in which the only end was death by musketry at the Luneta on 115 years ago. Tapos na po.